on the A twist of the Virchow for theories, which I think is useful. And binomial symmetry also extends to the B twist and to more general three-dimensional theories. And it's somewhat analogous to the relationship between more traditional topological field theories like Chern-Simons theory and chiral algebra. So I will start with a construction by Witten, which several of you, I'm sure, are familiar with, or even wrote papers about, which concerns the definition of an analytically continued path integral. So suppose that you're given some path integral for some theory, some action, some fields. And usually, you would just think about it as, broadly speaking, as an integral over all possible fluctuations of these real fields. So, you have some d-dimensional space-time and some maps into the space of fields. Well, anyway, let's say this is three-dimensional integral. But there are situations where you might want to analytically continue this path integral, meaning take the fields to assume possibly complex values and integrate over some contour in the space of complexified field configurations. Why would you want to do that? Well, one very physical possibility is that you might want to do a subtle point evaluation of this integral. Perhaps even very concretely, you are trying to simulate this on the lattice, and you, when this action is has a fluctuating phase, this can be very hard. Perhaps you might improve the situation by changing the integration contour so that this is actually real or has a nice real part. People are actually trying to do things like that for QCD. Or perhaps your action was a bit ill-defined. There was some problem with it that prevented you from using the standard integration contour. A classical example is if you try to define a quantum mechanical system whose phase space is CP1, typically you can write some action with a coupling in front, which has to be integrally quantized, and roughly gives you the dimension of Hilbert space you're going to get when you quantize this phase space. If you try to work with a parameter with a coupling which is not quantized, something has to get broken. You cannot do the path integral with a phase space which is literally CP1, but you can analytically continue the complexification of CP1, and you still get interesting structures, perhaps infinite dimensional representations of SC2 instead of finite dimensional representations. If I think about this as a sort of an integral with a choice of contour, then, and perhaps some insertions of operators, this path integral sort of gives you a pairing between a space of possible integration contours and a space and a collection of possible operators you can insert inside here, modulo world identities, so integration by parts identities. And the space of possible integration contours is a nice vector space as cohomological in nature. I mean, if this was a finite dimensional integral, this would really be some cohomology of my space of fields of possible paths such that this integral converges. And you know, when I see cohomology, I tend to think about spatial states or some supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And so here is some kind of a pairing between a space of states and something like a local operator of some sort. And Witten's perspective was that you can identify this with a configuration one dimension higher.
Something. lights up with the blackboard.
Sorry. Am I using the white chalk?
No, I think it's the lights.
Yeah, it's back there.
Also, close the shutters.
Yes?
While they're changing the lights, can I ask, the space of contours, at least in finite dimensions, is really, it has an integral structure. It makes sense to
yes, that's right.
Are you able to see that integral structure in this? Will that integral structure be visible in the story you're going to tell?
I would think so. Alto. Well, I'm not completely sure. I would have to think about it a bit more carefully. Usually this, yeah, from the point of view of quantum mechanics, right, why is there an integral structure in the cohomology is a little bit funny. You might have to go in higher dimension to understand this integral structure as perhaps these coefficients are dimensions of some vector spaces or something like that. That's right. So it might be possible. I've not thought about it well. Okay. So Wittgenstein's statement is that there is an equality between this path integral and the path integral for a very special theory in one dimensional Heiger. So if this was a theory T, there would be some other theory T prime, which is roughly supersymmetric. And then you call four supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which is defined as a Landau-Ginzburg model, with superpotential, which is just the action. So I can give some more details about this, but I don't think many will be actually needed for what we're discussing. So this is a theory which has fields, bosonic fields, which are essentially a lift of these fields to one-dimensional Heiger, and some fermionic superpartners.
So when you say quantum mechanics, you're considering quantum mechanics on this half-life?
Yeah, what I mean is that you take this quantum mechanics with degrees of freedom, which are maps from MD to some field space. And so this essentially becomes a theory, quantum field theory in D plus one dimensions, which has one direction which is treated very differently from the others. So this theory has no reason to be Lorentz invariant, for example. So this is a supersymmetric model that has a bunch of supercharges. And so to whatever calculation you're doing here, can be mapped to some supersymmetric calculation here. So there is a sort of a subset of all possible correlation functions you could compute here, which happens to coincide with the result of this contour integral. That these calculations typically look like I pick a state at infinity, which labels corresponds to my choice of integration cycle. Then I have a very special boundary condition, which is sort of a deformed Neumann boundary condition. And I place local operators at the boundary, which preserve the supersymmetry. And then this is supposed to give me that. Now there are, the statement works best if your choice of integration contour happens to be a thimble, meaning sorry, perhaps I should say it a bit better. So a particularly nice situation is one where this action has critical points, which are is isolated. Then what you can do is to do a path integral where you just say that the fields go to some critical point at infinity. That's the simplest thing you can do. Then what Witten shows is that this path integral localizes on solutions of a gradient flow equation. Something like that, schematically. And so what this calculation actually reproduces is a path integral whose integration cycle is sort of the cycle that was called the thimble, which is the envelope of the of all these gradient flows which end at the critical point. So let me draw a concrete picture. So, for example, let me take an action which is just phi cubed for a zero-dimensional path integral. Because I'm trying to do the integral of e to the phi cubed. So, if I look at a phi plane, this integral blows up in, say, along the positive real axis. This function I'm trying to integrate, but goes to zero asymptote very fast along the negative real axis. It actually goes to zero in a whole vector, sort of. And then there is another sector up here where the same is true, and down here. So there are sort of three sectors in the plane where my integrand goes to zero very fast. And so the typical convergent integral I can do is something like this. Or perhaps like this. I could also do that, but this is the same as the sum of those two. So in this case, the basis of my integration cycles is two-dimensional, correspond to sort of this gamma 1 and gamma 2. This remains true if I also add some deformation, like that. Okay. Now, if I turn on the deformation like this, so that this has two critical points, I equal to plus minus 1, a particular basis in the space is given by the gradient flow equations which pass through sort of pass through these critical points. So these are the sort of contours that you will encounter if you try to do a subtle point evaluation. Because along these contours, you can show that the integrand is real and decays as fast as possible. So they're sort of the best possible contours to do your integral. If you're trying to do other integrals, you can always expand them into some of these. There is a whole technology of Lesher symbols, which I don't want to discuss now. Now, so in this particular case, Witten setup would be a sort of a quantum mechanical system with some Landau-Ginzburg action. And I would do a path integral with some very special boundary condition here at time equal to zero. And I would say at infinity, I pick phi goes to one, or I pick phi equal to goes to minus 1. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Specific deformation you use, the two thimbles are on top of each other and you're on a wall.
I'm sorry, that's possible. Are you sure it was not the +3?
If it's a +3, it works.
Sorry, okay, fine. Okay.
Because now one of the thimbles can flow up.
Very good.
One can flow down.
Okay, so, sorry, so now this quantum, if you do this quantum mechanics for integral, you get the same as the integral of e to the phi cube on one of the two thimbles. All right, so in a sense, this sort of classical boundary conditions give you a basis of all possible states. And in principle, you could do calculation with more general states. For example, I could use a state which corresponds to doing an integral over this, or some other complicated contour or whatever. So this can give you at least a way you can at least attempt to define the choice of the space of possible integration contours for some path integral in dimension higher than zero. If you can understand this theory or make sense of it, then the space of integration contours will be just the space of states. Or perhaps of boundary supersymmetric preserving boundary conditions, because you know I don't have to go all the way to infinity if I want to make something meaningful. Maybe I can just put another topological boundary or something like that. The specific details will depend on what you're actually doing. Okay? I can try to make statements, but it's hard to make such statements which are absolutely universal and independent of what particular thing you're trying to do. I mean, there should be subtleties in trying to define integration contour for path integrals. And anyway, today I'm going to use this machinery sort of backwards. So as I said, if you start with a generic S, your theory in one dimension higher will look weird. But for some very special actions, you get theories in one-dimensional Heiger which you can recognize and you might be interested in independently. And then this becomes sort of, this can be used backwards, right? You can learn statements like the space of states of these interesting theories happen to coincide with the space of possible solutions of world identity for this simpler theory. So this is what I want to do today. I want to find a setup such that this is the A twist of a 3D Nicol Four theory. And then I'll be able to learn things like the space of states of this theory must be the same as the space of solutions of world identities for some two-dimensional model.
Which is the same as conformal blocks.
Right, conformal blocks, exactly. If I can adjust things so that this is for example, a chiral algebra, then I get nice. I mean, if I have a situation where here I have other computational methods which allow me to define the possible solutions of world identities in an independent way, then this will teach me things about this theory. Right, I also want to observe that depending on what you do, there might be some of the things you insert here on the left, things like the polynomials of the fields, correspond to local operators here on the right too. But there are also situations where some of the insertions you're putting here might themselves require analytic continuation in their definition. So they will become lines. Will become endpoints of lines in one dimension Heiger. So one of the things we'll hopefully learn is some interesting way to think about the category of lines for the 3D twisted model. Right, another thing I should mention is that right, so here I wrote sort of the gradient flow equations which are relevant for a situation where you don't have gauge fields. There is a generalization of this, where you include, but you also have gauge fields. So, and perhaps we should start by discussing that. How many people are somewhat familiar with the notion of left-shift symbols, and how many are not? I should probably say a few more words about this. Let me start with it. Start from that. Okay, so let's go back to this sort of zero-dimensional integral. Just in one variable, explicitly. The typical situation that you might encounter is that you have some integral like this along the real axis, perhaps it's convergent, but such that this action fluctuates very wildly along the real axis. And so one possible strategy to address this is to deform the contour. Try to find some other contour which would make the evaluation better behave. So a particularly nice contour, one thing you could do is to try to sort of move in some direction such that your integrand is getting as small as possible. This is kind of a gradient flow for the real part of S. This will push your integration contour away from the real axis. You'll keep pushing it. At some point, you get stuck. At some point where the gradient flow stops. This is the point where the derivative of S is zero. So a critical point. And that, so you end up with some contour that passes through the critical point. Now, once you do that, you can try to pick a contour such that when you go out of the critical point, S decreases as fast as possible. The real part of S decreases as fast as possible. So if you do that, your integral will probably be well approximated by e to the S evaluated at the critical point. This is the spirit of the saddle point approximation. And sometimes when you deform this contour, you need to account for several critical points. Maybe this contour that passes through here goes away in some direction, which is not the one you wanted. You had to combine with some other contour, passes to another critical point, and gives you something homologous to the original contour. Now, the gradient flow equation for the real part of S looks like this. I'm using a metric, the phi bar, and I hope I'm not forgetting any i's. I might be. I don't think I am. Let's see. Let's check. So
that's okay.
Okay. So if I multiply this by phi dot. I get something like that. So you see that the real part of S decreases uniformly along the flow. The imaginary part of S is constant. So this is a, this gives you a nice, so there is no risk of fluctuating phases. Okay, if you do an integral around this contour, and there's a solution of this equation, you don't have to worry about huge cancellations, and your integral is decreasing as fast as possible. So perfect. So you can generalize this in more dimensions, right? Typically, what you need is a clear manifold or something like that. So you have you can write something like some equation like that. Okay. Now, as I was mentioning, there are, you can apply a strategy like this to gauge, with, in path integrals, to gauge symmetries as well. So, you might have a situation where you have some action which is invariant under some gauge transformations. And you're doing a path integral with a measure divided by the action of the group. We want to integrate over the space of orbits of the gauge group. So when you complexify this story, you land naturally in a place where there is a clear quotient. But the complexified, so if I have my original space, real space X, and I complexify to some complex space C. And then I have some space modulo a compact group. Then it's naturally living inside the Keeler quotient of the space. So in practice, right, you can sort of extend the integral of the holes, divide by the volume of the group, and sort of put the delta function for the moment map, which perhaps you could write in Fourier transform like that. It's just to motivate roughly the fact that there is an interesting modification of the equations, where you replace the time derivative with a complexified time derivative. And you add an extra equation. So I don't know exactly. This is, if you do something like a gauge version of the story with a gauge Landau-Gainsbourg group theory, then this is the sort of gradient flow equation that you find.
Sorry, what was sigma and mu?
Mu is the moment map, sorry. And sigma is an auxiliary real field, not complex, but real, which complexifies the flat connection. I guess if you call this just complexified connection, then this is sort of a commutator of del and del bar.
I think what's confusing is that mu is a moment map, but mu bar is a coordinate.
Sorry. So I just wanted to mention these equations because if you try to read Wittgenstein's papers that use this technology for section Simons theory, it would be important. I have to say, at some point, yeah, I have not thought enough about these equations, but they seem to be a nice way to produce integration cycles inside a Keeler quotient. I mean, see, perhaps one thing I can try to say is that I'm not sure. I'll leave it at that. Okay, so right, so if I have a zero-dimensional integral or gauged integral, I get an equal four quantum mechanics associated with whose space of states is the space of integration contours. Now I'd like to look at some higher dimensional examples. So the next canonical example, which was employed by Witt and Gukovit and Van Weis, concerns the analytic continuation of a quantum mechanical system. So for simplicity, let's think about a topological quantum mechanical system, something which has no Hamiltonian. So the canonical example is quantum mechanics in R, which is an action sort of PQ dot, the first order action. More generally, if you have some interesting phase space, with some symplectic form omega, you can try to write locally omega as the exterior derivative of some lambda, and then write an action which is the pullback of lambda. Of course, you cannot do it globally. So if you, between different patches, you'll have to shift by something exact. This gives the sort of quantization conditions that I was mentioning for CP1, for example. But anyway, if you suppose I'm trying to sort of apply the procedure here to this model. So how would the gradient flow equations look like? I call this direction T, perhaps I should call it Y, to avoid confusion with the time of the quantum mechanics. So, and again, I want to stress that studying the integration contours of quantum mechanics, or how to do the subtle point evaluation of quantum mechanics, is a fun problem that people are still curious about even now. Neil, for example, that's right. We spent a lot of time discussing. So, which kind of equations do I find? I need here the variation of this with respect to p. It sounds like p dot. Which actually not that bad in the sense that they should remind you of some Cauchy-Riemann equations. If I combine, let me write this as right, if I can try to by something like this. Right, so the real part of this equation is the one on top. The imaginary part is the complex conjugate of this. It's also true. So my gradient flow equations become an equation for something to be, for some map to be holomorphic. Now, which sort of two-dimensional model do you know where localization forces you to consider holomorphic maps is the A model. So the statement is that if you try to analytically continue a quantum mechanical system with a phase space P, then this can be mapped to certain calculations in the A model on P. Calculations where you have some very special boundary condition called a BCC brain. And you do things that, for example, now let me, I'll give you some example in a moment, but so this tells you that there is a boundary condition in the A model, which gives you all the information you might need to study analytic continuation of quantum mechanics.
So when you start the topological quantum mechanics, you wrote down as symmetry SP2n, whereas the continuation has symmetry un. So why did that symmetry?
No, it's U2n.
Is it complex? So what, I mean, it's supposed
to be. Right, so we started with, say, true real dimensions.
So P.
And we ended up with two complex dimensions.
So it's PC, gotcha.
It's PC.
Okay.
Right. Sorry, I corrected while you were asking the question. So for example, if I wanted to study a quantum mechanics whose phase space was CP1, I would have to use some complexification of CP1 here. Which will be essentially a T star of CP1. So which sort of questions might I ask in an analytically continued quantum mechanics? One possible question is, well, I take my time to be a circle, and I put operators along this time circle. So this defines a trace on the space of local operators in the quantum mechanics. Now, if you have a true physical quantum mechanics with a very canonical choice of integration contour, this will give a very specific trace. No confusion there. But if you do an analytically continued quantum mechanics, well, you will have still some work. So what are the constraints I might have to have on a trace? Right. The basic constraint on the trace, right, is that if I have two operators, the trace of a commutator vanishes. So a trace is sort of a linear map on my operator algebras that kills all the commutators. But in general, I might have multiple possible traces. I don't always have a single trace. For example, suppose that my algebra is, let's see, what is a good example? Right, the universal developing algebra of SL2. And I fix the Casimir to be a specific value. Right. When lambda is integral, this is precisely what I would have found if I quantize CP1. I have a Hilbert space an irreducible representation of SL2, because SL2 is the SL2 that rotates CP1. Local operators would be just matrices acting on this representation. But by the sure lemma, I think, the matrices can just be seen as can be generated all by taking by starting with the SL2 generators and multiplying them. So, and of course, if I have a finite dimensional representation of SL2, there is a very obvious trace, which is just the trace on that representation. Now, in the analytically continuous setup, I have the same operator algebra, but I might not have a nice finite dimensional Hilbert space. So you can ask, what is the space of possible traces on these algebras? It's an interesting question. It has an answer. But I can try to answer that question algebraically, just solving this problem.
Answer is zero.
Hmm?
Zero for imaginary.
I think that's, I forget. No, I think it's not, sorry. I don't think it's zero. So what you can do, well, let's try to study it algebraically. What I can do is I can put a little twist in my trace first. No, study a trace where if I go around the trace, I get rotated a little bit. Then I can pick some nice module for this algebra. The modules are essentially the Verma modules of SL2. With, I guess, weights lambda and minus lambda minus one. See, if lambda is integral, the finite dimensional representation is sort of a quotient of one by the other. But for lambda generic, they have no relation with each other. Remember, these are very familiar modules, right? There is a highest weight vector, and then there is the first descendant to the highest weight vector, and so on and so forth. And you can do traces in here. For example, let's do the trace of one, right? And then trace of, sorry. What I wanted to say, instead of doing traces, I can do trace of e to the beta j3. I can insert e to the beta j3 in the trace, and then I remove it. This is the effect. So the contribution of this, suppose I want to compute the trace of e to the beta j3. Right? I get, from here I get e to the lambda beta. From here I get e to the lambda beta plus beta. And then I get e to the lambda beta plus 2 beta, etc. So the whole trace is just e to the lambda beta over 1 minus e to the beta, or something like that, the trace of 1. If I do the same trace on this guy, I get similar expression with e to the minus lambda plus 1 beta. Now, if I take the difference of these quantities, so each of these does not have a good limit as beta goes to 0. But the difference does. So the trace of 1 has a nice limit. So I can sort of define a trace formally as the beta to 0 limit of trace of e to the beta j3 on the difference between the two modules. And this will give me some answer.
I mean, because you took that limit, your cyclicity of the trace could.
Well, the cyclicity of the trace is a bit twisted by beta, and then when I send beta to 0, it's restored. So before with beta, I had two possible traces. When I turn off beta, I still have one. And it's literally an analytic continuation of the trace on the finite dimensional representation, because the finite dimensional representation was the difference between the two.
How do you see the map from the space of possible integration cycles?
That's right. Now let's do it this way instead of algebraically. Now I had to study the A model on a half cylinder. And I had to put here a choice of state for my A model. And so the space of traces of this, the space of possible definitions of a analytically continued quantum mechanic on a circle will be given by the space of possible states for the A model on a circle, which I think is something like the
one cohomology of T star of CP1.
Right. Or just cohomology. Yeah, quantum cohomology. Yeah, you're right. So it's going to be the quantum cohomology of T star of CP1. Yes. I mean, these are not examples. I don't want to spend too much time on the examples because that's not the main topic. And I'm a bit behind. But if you're curious about any specific point of the explanation, we can have another seminar next week and I can prepare more details. But I want to just give an overview of this, of the general structure. I'm not sure. So it's just the space of possible traces, the space of possible, on the algebra of a local operator must be the same as the space of possible states.
Like what one would say is
on
like
a circle.
That the BCC ring gives you a deformation quantization of T star of CP1.
Right.
Depending on the parameter, the global sections of that is the quotient of USLT by the quadratic Casimir.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're studying the Hochschild homology.
That's right. So here you just recover the fact that the space of traces on the algebra is the same as the Hochschild homology almost by definition, right?
Yeah.
And coincides with the space of states on a circle.
Like whenever I do deformation quantization,
right.
Hochschild homology recovers the cohomology of whatever I'm manifolding
on. That's right. But I can have another independent way to think about this just as the A model on the circle.
And I mean, this is exactly this quantum Ikeda.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think so. So probably for the quantum Ikeda, you'd want to sort of think about this half line as a cigar in the 3D n equal 4 theory, potentially. Because you want to use mirror symmetry at some point.
Well.
Or not. You might want to use mirror symmetry.
I don't know. This guy's self-dual, so.
Yes, but for a general manifold, you might want to use mirror symmetry. So there is another quantum mechanical example which is interesting. Suppose I want to study the quantum mechanics of a segment. So I have my phase space, and when I want to have a path integral on a segment, I need to give some boundary conditions to the endpoints of the segment. So I'll have maybe a choice of Lagrangian. My field will have to live in Lagrangian as one end. And inside of another Lagrangian in the other end. I'm trying to define a quantum mechanics path integral on a finite interval of time. I need to specify some boundary conditions. A typical thing I could do is what's the amplitude for a particle to go from here to there? And then a boundary condition will be I fix the position and let the momentum fit. But in general, I can pick a Lagrangian. So now from a purely algebraic point of view, right, the sort of problem I'm looking at is kind of I'm quantizing the algebra functions on this phase space. This Lagrangian quantized to some modules, perhaps. And this is a tensor product of the two modules. Because an operator acting in a product, when an operator is acting here, must be the same as in the product when the operator is acting here. But sort of the higher dimensional perspective is that I'm studying the A model on a strip. Now I have BCC boundary conditions on the segment. And here I have A brains associated to these complex Lagrangians. So I want to stress that usually this setup gives you situations which have quite a bit of supersymmetry. And some of the objects you encounter might preserve half of them, but the whole picture will only have to preserve one in order for localization to work. So these are both A brains in the A model, but it's actually an A model on a complex symplectic manifold. It has A 4.4 supersymmetry. And these brains preserve different halves of that 4.4 supersymmetry, but they preserve a common topological supercharge, which is what's used for localization. So they're all A brains, but they are different type of A brains. I could say words like BAA brains or ABA brains, but not useful here.
Sorry, no. this is a 2D 4.4 supersymmetry?
Yes, that's right. So in principle, in general, a priori, I would only have a 4.4 quantum, an inequal 4 quantum mechanics, so 4 superchargers going this direction. The special thing that happens when I'm studying a quantum mechanical system of that form is that I gain extra Lorentz symmetry, and I also gain extra supersymmetry. So in at the end, this theory here has like 8 supercharges instead of 4. Now, so to stress, there are a variety of calculations I can do on the A model which would not have an immediate one-dimensional image. But whenever I have a picture that sort of looks like R plus times something, then I have a good chance that it will map to a lower dimensional problem.
So BL1 and BL2 preserve the same half of 4.4?
Yes. So now the local operators I could have put along the segment become local operators on the BCC brain. The local operators that I could have put at the endpoint become homes from BCC and NBL1, BCC and NBL2. And the space of possible integration contours, which should be the sort of the tensor product of these two modules, should become the space of states on the A model between these two brains. So my integration contours now will belong to home between boundary conditions. These two things are working well. Okay. All right, so perhaps something I should say better is that so here we have an A model calculation. Here we have a calculation that in favorable circumstances is purely algebraic. There is probably something about P being sufficiently affine, so that there is a way, and there is nice algebra of local operators, and all calculations can be done purely algebraically in terms of properties of this operator algebra. And I assume that similar affineness conditions will also occur in the 3D n equal 4 setup I want to discuss next. And this perspective also works in a gauge setup. So I can have a gauge quantum mechanics, and on the same side, I find a gauged A model. So I find a any 4.4 gauge theory coupled to some matter degrees of freedom. And here, right, I have a bunch of questions I'll ask the audience after the seminar, because to me, one of the most interesting problems to understand well is that, so if my, you know, typically, okay, in two dimensions, I can use sigma models, but especially when I go to three dimensions, it's much better to use gauge theory. So my matter fields naturally live in CN or in RN, and then I have gauge fields that make interesting shapes. So without the gauge fields, I'm definitely very confident that sort of algebraic calculations in d dimensions match the calculations in one dimension higher, like spaces of states, and things like that. And I would like that to be remain true after one introduces gauge fields, as long as it's done properly. So presumably here now I have an algebra together with some ghosts and some gauge invariants, and I had to work everything in a very, very derived way. But I would like to know if when I do things properly in the right way, I still get the correct answers. Let me use the last. I have until 12 or 12:05.
Until the audience rebels.
Huh?
I don't know how.
12:10, 1. But I keep going, you stop me. Okay, so what can I do in two dimensions? Well, there is a natural generalization of that. Where I replace the time derivative with an anthropomorphic derivative. This is what's called a beta gamma system. A small subtlety is that for this action to be sensible, because this is a 0-1 form, I need a 1-0 form somewhere. So I have to do, if I am happy treating these two fields undemocratically, I could say that gamma is a function and beta is a one form. Or I could say that they're both sections of K2 to 1/2 fermions, spinors. This will let me treat things more symmetrically, preserve an SL2 symmetry rotating beta into gamma, but it will have the cost that I need to pick a spin structure. And presumably I can do curved versions of this, where beta gamma lives in some appropriate manifold. The obvious possibility is that, you know, gamma lives in some manifold and beta lives in the cotangent direction of the manifold. But other possibilities should be available. So the target could be C2, but it could be some more thing. And there are all sorts of anomalies and obstructions in trying to define beta gamma systems in manifolds which are more complicated than that base. And I'm not an expert on those anomalies, but there are some experts in the audience. So suppose I apply now the usual technology. Which sort of equations do I end up with? Well, they're not going to be terribly self-evident. Going to get something like this. But if one stares at them long enough and looks at a list of three-dimensional theories which might give rise to these equations, you will recognize them as sort of BPS equations for the 3D A twist, for the A twist of a 3D Nicol Four theory. In particular, although it's not immediately obvious, they are topological. They are Lorentz invariant. So the same way as these equations happen to have a hidden rotation symmetry, which mixes Q and P bar at the same time as mixing Y and tau. Here there is a hidden rotational symmetry. These are really Dirac equations. So beta and gamma can be thought of naturally as a spinner in 3D.
Isn't it funny that bosonic spirits come?
Well, not funnier than this.
Well, yeah, but were we supposed to find like an ordinary, unitary 3D Nicol Four theory?
Well, the theory is unitary, but the topological twist of the theory is not unitary.
Oh, I see. So when you twist.
So when you, the 3D Nicol Four theory has a nice hypermultiplet. And then when you topologically twist it, the symmetry rotating, the hypermultiple gets mixed with symmetry rotating spacetime, and the hypermultiple bosons become a spinner. And this is a Dirac equation. So we're in one of those nice situations where the higher dimensional theory has an emergent Lorentz symmetry and can be recognized as something of independent interest. So we learned that the chiral cohomology, so let's take a situation like this. I have a Riemann surface, I have my beta gamma system, the final Riemann surface, and then I map it to something higher dimensional. Then I learned that the space of possible solutions of, well, okay. Now, if I were to try to give a meaning to the possible path integrals for the beta gamma system, because this is a nice chiral algebra, what I would do is just study conformal blocks, meaning I would consider correlation functions with a bunch of betas and gammas inserted, and I would solve essentially these correlation functions would be holomorphic in the position, meromorphic in the position of beta and gamma, with singularities when beta and gamma meet each other, which are controlled by the OPE. And just the space of solutions of this word identity that has the del bar gamma is zero away from other insertions, del bar beta is zero away from other insertion, is just some finite dimensional space usually. Oh, well, not finite dimensional perhaps. It's just a space that is well defined.
So this is what
it builds in that mode. Right. That's right. So physically you call it conformal blocks, mathematical chiral cohomology or factorization. Homology or cohomology? Homology? Yeah, chiral homology or factorization homology. So the chiral cohomology of the beta gamma system on some Riemann surface, according to this construction, is predicted to coincide with a space of states. On the same Riemann surface. So this could have been just beta gamma fields is valued in C, maybe they're valued in some non-trivial manifold, maybe they're valued in Cn, but I also gauged the story. And then I get a 3D gauge theory on the other side. So this is a very general setup. There are important subtleties. In particular, there are anomalies which can spoil this picture.
So maybe that's a good point to stop and.
Okay. Yes, that's right.
Everyone is, I certainly would like to
I can
continue next week.
Yeah.
If
I'd be happy to.
Group. All right, great. So we'll plan on same bat time, same bat channel next week.